this one owner of a huge shop, which most recently, it was known as Goldstein and Levine, and then it became known as K. Hartley Frost, making dresses primarily for Sears Roebuck, told me that I asked him what he was doing out there in Johnstown, and he said that in 1932 or 1933, he had asked David Dubinsky of the Ladies' Garment Workers to cut the wages from 18 cents down to 16 cents or something of that sort of an hour. The union refused. He moved out to Johnstown and was able to hire people at 13 cents. It's very interesting. I said, well, wasn't that all a waste in time over a period of years since you're now unionized? And he said, no. And I use this example in class. He said, in time, he said, I found it was better to have a rule book, whether you call it a union contract or personnel policy. And almost pathetically, he said, young man, and I qualified him, he said, young man, do you know what it is to bargain individually with 2,000 angry women? He said, I wanted a rule book. He said, when the union came in here, I didn't resist. Now we say, there's the book, here's the rule. You want to have an argument, go to the union. He said, that's part of the history. Another thing, too, is that my own experience has been that I have found that Jewish employers have been more susceptible and accepting of unions ahead of others. It is no coincidence that the first unionized nursing home in Pittsburgh was the Jewish Home and Hospital. They are less resistant, more accepting. Now, this, as I said, this interest continued. Now, meanwhile, in the post-war period, I got my master's degree under the GI Bill, got it in 1954, and soon after that, I was approached by Penn State, which had labor studies programs for union groups, that is, either union leadership or particular union locals, and they would give them courses in handling grievances, labor history, trade union administration, collective bargaining, things of that sort. So I began to teach in their program part-time in the Western Pennsylvania area, and at the same time I was teaching at Pitt, giving courses in personnel administration. And I've continued in both programs on a part-time basis. During the last 10 years, I've reduced my labor education programs with Penn State and spent the time pretty much with the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs at Pitt in a program that I helped set up for personnel and labor relations in the public sector.
How did you go about enforcing? What tactics did you use?
Well, the enforcement was per a standard procedure, which has changed somewhat over the years. Initially, we would not give the employer any notice that we were coming in. The rationale being that this would deny him an opportunity to push the children out the back door. After a while, we found that that might have been necessary, and maybe necessary today in some parts of the South and the Southwest, but certainly not in the Pittsburgh area where I have worked solidly, so that now appointments might be made beforehand to come in. One does include a trip through the plant. One might look at applications to see whether any underage minors have been employed. The law covered minimum wage, overtime, and child labor, you see, so that this was one of our responsibilities. We did not find very much child labor in the Pittsburgh area because in the younger group, there's always been a very high incidence of unemployment, and you can just as easily get a 19-year-old or 18-year-old as you can a 14-year-old, and you don't have the hazards that go with it. There's a plentiful supply of young people at the minimum wage, which is now $3.35. So that part of this gap is pretty well gone. You have to keep in mind, too, that Pittsburgh was a center of unionization. in Allegheny County, and I think this is still true today, there are more union members per 1,000 employees than anywhere else in the world. People forget this was the home of the CIO, the home of the steelworkers, the home of the mine workers. So that this unquestionably has a rub-off effect on other employers. In plain words, the sweatshop type employer does not come into Pittsburgh. There were a few garment factories in Pittsburgh which had that. The stoking factories, similar occupations. You don't see them in Pittsburgh. You don't see consumer products. In fact, lower wage firms have tended to move to Pittsburgh. Consumer items historically have somewhat lower wages. H.J. Heinz would be an example. H.J. Heinz has very few employees here as compared to what it did before. You might remember as youngsters we used to take trips through Heinz. They don't have many more. There's no production to show people. They have a few items that are made, but the bulk of their employees are elsewhere because food processing is a lower paid industry. It was a natural thing for paper craft, which makes wrappings, to move a good deal of their production to other parts of the country, because they're competing with lower wage industries. So that has had, market forces have had a tendency to wipe that out.
Now, they taught somebody like Heinz that they move the production closer to the source of growing. So in other words, that's just part of the story.
Well, that's part of it. I think it's oversimplification to say that labor is the only item. An employer has to look at his total cost, one item of which is labor. Now, one reason why the garment industry and the cigar industry were that concerned was that a very heavy percentage of the total cost of the product was labor. So the garments that you're wearing probably involves 30% labor cost. On the other hand, if you have something that's just punching stuff out, 5% of the cost might be labor. And as a matter of fact, automation has reduced the argument that labor is the single item, the single reason why one might move from one place to another. So you have to look at taxes, land costs, availability of skilled labor, transportation, all sorts of factors in coming to a conclusion as to whether it's more worthwhile to be in one place than another. You can't ascribe it to any single item, although sometimes people try to oversimplify it.
Well, while we're on the subject, what do you think the future of the labor union is in Pittsburgh today?
Well, I think just as it's labor is quite weak today, and it is weak all over the country. This is demonstrated by give back and concession contracts, companies resisting unions, decertification going from union to non-union. So this is a kind of a bleak period, and to some extent this reversal is aided and abetted by the Reagan administration. When Reagan fired all the air controllers, this was kind of a predictive shock. On the other hand, conversely, when Roosevelt and Truman were presidents, this was supportive of it. So the attitude of the national administration is very often important. I think that this plateau will continue for a while, but then I think you're going to see a resurgence of unionization in certain areas which historically have never unionized or very little. And that is your technical workers, your computer operators, your systems analysts, even your minor executives, hospitals, which are somewhat organized, will have that kind of presence as well. So I think it all depends upon the extent to which the pendulum swings. I think if employers take advantage of their bargaining, too much advantage of their bargaining position today, they will be generating that reaction. If the employers don't take great advantage of it, this period of low-level unionism will probably continue. I remember the quote of Walter Reuther, who said, "The best organizer I have is the highest paid man in the industry, and he isn't even on my payroll. His name is Henry Ford, and I think that is typical of what you have. I have always pointed out that employers very often organize better than the organizers do. But that's a personal philosophy.
Chuck, did you have a question?
You speak of enforcement through inspection. Is that all that was necessary for enforcement?
Well, you would inspect, and part of it would be to look at the records and check those out, and interview employees for confirmation, so that you would try to get the whole picture. Sometimes you would have to be quite innovative. I remember one instance in which I had an employer whose employees were told to come to work at 7 o'clock and to punch their time clock at 8 o'clock. So they gave an hour of free labor to the employer. The employees were intimidated. I was unable to get any kind of help at all from them, and the records all meshed. However, I went to the local power company, and I said, is there any way of measuring when the demand for power goes up at that plant? And they said, oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, if we didn't turn up our supply at about 6:58, that plant over there would blow every fuse we've got, every transformer. So that I was able to develop it that way. On the other hand, I was able to have one the opposite way, because one of the things, a corollary of enforcement, was not to say that all employers are wrong and all employees are right. I remember I had an instance where an employer did not keep any record of time. He had about 7 people in his office who came and entered a complaint saying that they worked 9 hours a day, which was 45 hours a week, and didn't get any overtime. And the employer came in and he said, I don't know how I can prove it. I don't have any records or time cards or anything else. But I'm telling you, they leave at 5, not at 6, and therefore had a 40-hour week, but they all got together. So I happened to notice that he had some sort of a protective agency label on his door and the tape that you have when there's an alarm. And I said, well, what's your alarm point on the door? That is, if anybody goes through that, the alarm goes off, or you tell the detective agency to ignore it. And he said, oh, it's about 5:05 or something like that. I went to the detective agency and I said, how many alarms have you had on that door? And he said, just one. And he said, the employer left something there, called us up and said he would be going back in at 5:20. And they showed it to me. And so I called them all in, and two of the people broke down and cried. They said, well, are you going to take us to jail? And they just lied. Now, you had to be innovative in how you approach this. And most of all, you had to be fair, because, and this has been another point of mine that I carried through to the time when I was director, and that was that it is very easy to intimidate the medium or small employer. The big employer has a legal staff, all kinds of resources. Nobody bluffs them. Nobody intimidates them. But for the medium and small employer, just the cost of legal defense, or just the power of government, has to be handled very, very carefully. This almost sounds like Barry Goldwater. And, you know, the conservatives will say that, but from a liberal perspective, too, you have to be very careful. Let us say that I go into an employer and say, you owe $3,000 in back wages. Chances are that he's going to pay that, whether or not my findings are correct, because his cost of going to court and defending himself will be $5,000. So that one of the things that I was careful about personally and insisted upon with my staff was that they try to come up with the findings. They had no right to legislate. I felt very strongly about some of the terrible working conditions that I found. I had no right to visit my philosophy on that employer. It was a violation of law, okay, but we carried out the law as it was.
Most of what you're speaking of seems to be the collection of data or facts or information upon which to work.
Right.
Then were there laws that executed penalties,
well,
and other such things
that
enforce
Well, we were then, at the end of the investigation, this is while I was a field man. Later on, I directed the people who did this. I would sit down with the employer and say, these are my tentative findings. I'd bounce it off to him, give him an opportunity to argue and see whether where I had gone wrong. For example, I remember having someone on the payroll, and I computed all kinds of back wages. It turned out the person had a heart attack, and the employer was counting him on the payroll, and he hadn't even been there for 6 months. So there are a number of areas. Or you may have, when you're interviewing people, you have to look at the human factor. You may be asking someone what hours he worked a year ago. Well, there's a human factor. We tend to remember in various ways. Perhaps he'd say, I worked 48 hours. Well, maybe I had forgotten to say how many times. Was it every week? Was it every other week? And so forth. Not only that, his estimate was subject to human error as well. So I was trying my best to get a fairly decent picture of where it was at. And I anticipated the employer would probably argue, even if I was right, because we're talking about his money. But still, one had to get the most balanced judgment they could. Sometimes it was very objective. It was very clear on the records. I remember going into a coal stripper up near Clarion, where just on the basis of the records, he owed close to $90,000. He had, this was right after the 30s, in fact, it was the early 40s before I went into service, and coal stripping was going like wildfire all over Pennsylvania. Well, during the time of the New Deal, there were a number of huge projects, Bonneville Dam, Passamaquoddy, and so forth, where these fellows ran these huge drag lines and bulldozers and so forth. They all came to north to Pennsylvania to go to work on stripping operations because they were running similar equipment, and there were southern draws all over central Pennsylvania. This employer was working these people dawn to dusk, high wages, to get these people to come in, but no overtime. High wage then was maybe $6 an hour. Okay? So here you'd have somebody working 90 hours, which would be 50 hours of overtime, and he would owe 50 times 3, so he would owe $150 in overtime for just that single week. And at that time, we went back 4 years. So it was very easy to put $90,000. At that time, tax rates were very high, and sometimes employers said, well, it was coming out of taxes anyway. So that you have examples of that sort. But things are pretty well settled down. The 40-hour week is fairly well observed. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that I project is that there will be pressure to shorten the work week. That, to some degree, has contributed to reducing unemployment in that you have more people to perform the hours. The point was, if you've got four people working 50 hours, you hire one person, you can have five people working 40 hours come to the same total. That was one of the reasons they passed this law. Keep in mind it was passed during the Depression. So that the other thing, too, is that we have many more short weeks than people think. The average office works 35 or 37 and a half hours, 9 to 5 with an hour for lunch or a half hour for lunch. The printing industry is anywhere from 32 and a half to 35. Many unions have negotiated shorter work weeks already. So I think you'll have a certain amount of pressure for shorter work weeks, and I think it'll occur in our lifetime. Historically, work weeks have dropped 8 hours every 10 years, and they have not dropped since the late 30s. So historically, it's time.
Do you have to penalize employers, seek reimbursement for employees, close shops?
Yes. I should have continued from that. We sit down and talk to the employer, and if there's no deliberate violation in the sense of doctored records or a history of similar violation, there is negotiation with the employer, and if he agrees, you then provide them with receipt forms to pay the employees those amounts. If one does not trust the employer, one might come out and witness the payment, or have the employer send the checks in and then have it paid through the enforcement office. In the event of deliberate violation, falsified records, prior history, and so forth, these files are prepared and sent to the regional solicitor for review. The regional solicitor might then take action ranging from a civil injunctive complaint to get an injunction to require back wages and future compliance to a criminal action asking for fines. The law provides for fines up to $10,000 in the event of willful violation. I've rarely seen anything that come anywhere near that. The reason why, I mean, if the court figures the payment of back wages as a punishment itself. First, on the other hand, the payment of back wages is now limited to 2 years, 3 years in case of fraud, so that one has these proceedings and sequences. In the overwhelming number of the cases, it is negotiated with the employer who pays for it.
No closings.
Oh, no, no. Because this would, in a way, be counterproductive. It would throw people out of work. Now, it may indirectly make the closings, because if an employer had a competitive advantage in paying lower wages than his competitor, and that was the only way he could stay in business, and then he had to come up to the minimum wage and couldn't compete at that level, he might then go out. Those things aren't that quickly visible to us. Employers go on for a while. Another area that relates to that is a special provision in the law for lower wages for handicapped people. There are sheltered workshops where in town, a great number of them run by the Association for Retarded Citizens, the Blind, the Broom Factory over here, things of that sort. There's a number of those for the handicapped. And there, I would have to make a determination as to what wage would be allowed in ratio to the handicap. In plain words, if the wage in the industry was, let's say, $4, and this handicap allowed this person 25% of the productivity of a normal person, who would then require $1 minimum wage, and that would be legal. In fact, I remember that an incident that occurred that cannot be mentioned because there's no harm, with respect to the Association for the Blind, which was then making brooms. I think brooms are kind of out of existence. I don't think they make them at all. I made a study of the broom factories in Allegheny County. There were 13 or 14 of them, and their productivity. And I found that the productivity of a blind worker was far better than any sighted person. So I canceled a certificate permitting them to pay lower than minimum wage. And they raised hell. They went to their congressman and everybody else. And my point was that having a disproportionate wage was unfair to non-handicapped people. They had to be protected as well. And that's the purpose, having a proportion so that you don't have to subsidize the employment of a handicapped person. That is, you can hire them and come out even. But at the same time, if you paid that person less than their proportional handicap, you were an unfair competitor to the others. And the thing I pointed out was that of the 13 shops originally studied, I think 11 or 12 had been gone out of business during the time that the blind workshop was expanding its sales. So they must have exerted tremendous pressure. And my old prof, who was more liberal than I was, Doc Tyson, was on the board, and he castigated me for that. And Washington suspended my suspension, and the blind workmen went out on strike. It was the darndest thing to see a blind picket line going on. They demonstrated for one day, and I think there were other cuts. It wasn't exclusively for that. And they then went back to paying the minimum wage. Now, we could never make them pay more than that. But that was one of the more striking instances. We had we have other responsibilities. So we would educate the public. I'd go out to seminars and forums and union meetings and management meetings. We don't talk about the law as well. Never gave up using my debating platform.
You had mentioned off the record about the fact earlier in the, about the 30s, that there were so many Jews in civil service jobs and why. Do you want to explain that now?
Yes. You have to realize that the spreading of Jews into more than certain small business self-employment is more or less characteristic of the World War II and beyond period. World War II created a demand for all kinds of professionals, all kinds of specialists, and Westinghouse, for example, brought them in by the thousands. And any patterns of discrimination were broken overnight. That is, if you wanted to discriminate, you just didn't get help, he said. So the big corporations brought people in, and if you have friends who are from other cities, chances are that they came during the war or subsequently. The World War II revolutionized the pattern of mobility and everything else. Before, you just were born and raised in your old neighborhood, and you might move a short distance, and that was about it. I think looking at some of the old neighborhoods of Pittsburgh, you still see that. You have third and fourth generations living in Bloomfield or Lawrenceville or places like Polish Hill, places like that. So that, but Jews, by and large, went into the professions, and service industries, and so forth. And they were the ones that were most affected by this mobility and the demand for people. However, during the 30s, there were not only very few jobs, but that was compounded by discrimination. The government did not discriminate. In other words, they had to take you objectively in terms of where you were on the list. There might be a little discrimination in terms of their right to choose one out of the top three, but that may have been practiced to a very limited degree. And as a result, there was a tremendous pouring of Jews into government jobs. If you went into a state liquor store, chances are you knew half the clerks you'd grown up with. A good friend of mine, Alex Cohn, who retired as head of the appellate branch of IRS, originally worked in the state liquor store in the 30s. And you can find any number of people whose first job was working in the state liquor store. When I worked with the Department of Public Assistance, an enormous number of the employees were Jews. You took the exam, you had the qualification, you got the job. And there, to some extent, the caring about learning and education would pay off in taking these exams. So that during the 30s, there were an enormous number of Jews to be found here and in Washington as well. And this influence continued because in time, as opportunities opened up elsewhere, fewer Jews tried to get into government. So the number kept decreasing, not because of discrimination, but because of greater opportunity elsewhere. But at the same time, the Jews who were in government and remained moved up. And I think I mentioned last time that just before I left government, my region out of Philadelphia, which covered about five or six states and had eight area offices, had as head of the eight of these offices, six Jews out of eight. And there was only one other Jew in the whole organization, one so-called non-com, or one of the members of the troops. We had very few Jews ever coming in. I rarely interviewed a Jewish applicant during the time that I was the director, which was my last 10 years. So in a way, this governmental pattern is a very nice reflection on what has happened elsewhere.
Now, can you tell us about your work as a labor mediator?
Well, that's my most recent job. In 1974, I retired from the federal service, and there were various other job opportunities. One of the reasons I retired was that I had put in 33 years, and the federal government has a very good pension system at age 55. I think I was 56 at the time, provided you put in at least 30 years. And that, together with any other employment, would represent a net increase. I had various job opportunities to go as director of employee relations with a couple of colleges and school systems, one private firm. But then I had taken the examination for labor mediator and felt that my experience might best apply there. And I've been very pleased that I accepted that job. I took the exam. I think I finished first in the state. And add to that veterans preference, so they almost had to hire me. So that my work since then, it's been 12 years now, has been very satisfying. And that is working with the parties in getting them together to settle this side of having a confrontation strike. Because whether they sit down and settle before or sit down and settle after, they're going to sit down and settle. Unless they just want to really kill each other, in which case you don't want to go in a way, just let them do it. Working with them, I find...
Go ahead.
You can put this in or not. That my Jewish background has